There's something hypnotizing about staring up at a night sky, especially when you know about the special things that are going on or maybe going on there. And we're going to be talking about some of those special astronomy events today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. And if you're like me, you enjoy looking up and seeing what's going on in the sky right now. But it's even better when you know in advance that there's some exciting things going on and then how to kind of understand what you're seeing. Always great to have Paul Kinzer with us. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. He's an active member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club, among other things. And Paul, always a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I love coming.
It's fun to have you. There's so many special events happening in the sky this summer. Tell us, what about there's one that's called the Conjunction of Planets.
Right, and that's actually happening right now. If you go out in the evening just after the sun goes down, you don't even have to wait till it's dark nowadays, you can see two bright stars in the sky, in the western sky, but they're not stars. They're the planets Venus and Jupiter. And they've been getting closer together in our sky for, well, months now. And in the next 2 weeks, they're going to close in on each other. And 2 weeks from today, on the 30th, they are going to be so close together in our sky that they will be closer together than the width of the full moon. And wow. I know when we look up at the full moon, often we imagine that it's really bigger in the sky than it is.
Yeah.
But take a look at the moon, which over the next, you know, you'll be able to see it in the next couple of weeks too. And just imagine those two planets will be closer together than the width of that. And just last week, a kid, I was doing an astronomy program, and a kid said, are they going to hit each other? And I explained that if you're able to draw it, it's kind of hard to say it in words, but if you're able to draw it, no, it's just in our line of sight as we're looking out at the sky, we're looking towards Venus, which is closer to the sun than us, and then we're looking out at Jupiter, which is now on the other side of the sun from us, and the two planets just appear close together. And as we go around the sun and they go around the sun, they just get close together in our sky.
It is fun to. It really is fun to just sit back and watch and look.
Yeah, it is, and the great thing is they are typically the two brightest planets in the sky, and Venus is getting brighter every night. It's now by far the brightest thing in the sky, and when it gets close to us like this, and it does get closer to us than any other planet, it's brighter than anything else in the sky except the moon at night. And Jupiter, though it's getting a bit dimmer because we are going away from it around the sun, it is still quite bright. When they're right next to each other in the sky, Venus will be a lot brighter, but you would be able to see both of them. If you took out a small telescope and looked at it, to see both planets in one field of view of a telescope, I'm really looking forward to it. In fact, that's the night I'll be in Ripon, and we'll be doing a star party, and I'll have telescopes there, and we will be looking at the sky.
Oh, that is so cool. And I mention it right now, but we'll mention it again later. You do so many events through the course of the summer, and I mean, you're going to be talking to a lot of people and working with a lot of people.
Yeah, I just last night was going through it. I'm going to be in 13 different towns over the summer with my portable planetarium and or my telescopes talking about the night sky.
Yeah, and we'll talk some more about that portable planetarium as well as we move along here today. But let's take a call from Melanie in Milwaukee. Melanie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there, how are you? I'm glad I'm on the road. So I'm home on leave currently. I'm in the Army and I'm stationed in Okinawa, Japan. And I love looking at the stars and skies. And anything that I ever read says, you know, when to expect meteor showers and planet alignments in the Western Hemisphere in the United States. But, you know, I'm hard-pressed to find something that's not in a foreign language, I suppose, to find out when I can see some night sky watching you know, over in Okinawa area. Do you have any suggestions as far as where I might look or good points of reference for that?
Well, luckily, Okinawa is in the northern hemisphere, just like we are. So most of the things, most of the things that we see here, you would just see either before us or after us. It depends if they're going to be, you know, it depends on what time of the night they're going to be here. And I don't, you know, my brain isn't wrapping around right now. Oh, how many hours difference would it be? There are a lot of different websites you can go to. There are also resources where you can simply ask questions. There's one called Cloudy Nights, cloudynights.com. You can go there, okay. And there are forums there, all different ones for just about every aspect of astronomy and other things you could imagine. And you could choose one there and just ask, how do I know when this is going to be? But if you find out about an upcoming event, and a meteor shower is a good example because those happen typically the same day every year, it should be fairly easy to just ask somebody, okay, help me out here. If it's going to be peaking at this time in, say, California, what does that mean for me over here in Okinawa? And they would be able to, they would answer those. They are very helpful folks there. And if ever I ask a question there, and some of my questions are very obscure, I almost always have an answer in just a few hours.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay. What was the name of that website again?
Cloudynights.com. And it's called that.
Okay.
Because that's where astronomers go when it's cloudy.
Okay, so Nights, and it's Nights with an S.
Right, cloudynights.com. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, outstanding. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Sure. All right, thanks, Melanie, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments. Are you a fan of stargazing or astronomy events? Are you looking forward to seeing? What have you seen lately? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you go for the Facebook page. And you can post your questions, comments, or maybe you've got kind of a cool photo. If you've taken a photo through your telescope of the night sky, or maybe you've got something, another star a like photo, we'd love to see it. Actually, Paul, you posted on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we've got something that, a photo that you took.
Yeah, I took this picture in 2009 of Jupiter. And
it's really cool.
Yeah, for me, it's a pretty good picture. I mean, some of the pictures people are taking of planets now make this one look pretty amateurish, but the exciting thing about it was I had heard that an asteroid or comet, and they decided it was an asteroid, a small one, had hit the planet Jupiter. And they ended up looking at amateur astronomers' photographs and video, and they were able to trace back, yep, something hit Jupiter, and it made a mark on it. And if you're able to go to the Facebook page, there's a picture of Jupiter. In the center is a dark spot.
Yeah.
That's the shadow of one of its moons. And the great red spot is also visible. But if you look up in the corner at about the 1 o'clock position, right near the edge, there's a little dark smudge. And other astrophotographers caught it much better than me. But I thought, oh, this is pretty neat. It's showing up in the image that I took. And it lasted for several days. And years before that, in 1994, people might remember Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. Two astronomers, actually very famous amateur pro-am, I guess you'd call it, discovered a comet, and it was a weird comet. They thought it was sort of spread out. And when they tracked its orbit, they realized this comet had gone past Jupiter in the past, and Jupiter's gravity had broken it up into a bunch of pieces. And then they did a little more math and figured out, oh my gosh, it's heading for Jupiter, and it's going to hit it. So they had many, many telescopes aimed at it. Some of the first really great photos from Hubble were of this comet, and everyone was very surprised at the very large dark spots that lasted, some of them, for many weeks after it did strike it. And that event really made people sort of sit up and take notice and wonder, what if one of those hit the Earth, and what can we do about it? And a lot has been done since to explore that very question.
Yeah, and I want to explore that with you a little bit, too. Someone asked, what's the difference between an asteroid and a comet?
Basically, an asteroid is a rock. or a lot of rocks sort of held together loosely by gravity. A comet has volatiles on it, so that if it either gets nearer the sun or at certain times, if it's got frozen, you know, out there, water is basically rock. But water and oxygen and other things that if they warm up, they melt.
Yeah.
And then the comet will have a sort of atmosphere, you know, it'll gases will come off it and stream away from it.
What, and just as long as we're on that topic, there I've seen there is quite an international organization that's looking at how do we
right, and I recently read from a link that we got from that I got from Cheyenne, the producer, about an organization that recently just had a sort of practice run on. Okay, we've just discovered an asteroid. It's going to hit the Earth in a certain amount of time. What can we do? And they went through a lot of scenarios, practicing events to try and stop it. And I like, if I can find it here, I like what the way they put it. You can either, there are three different ideas for if there's an asteroid heading for the Earth, how do you stop it? And they called them the nuke, the kick, and the tug. And in a couple of movies were made about an asteroid coming towards Earth, Armageddon, and I'm not remembering the other one.
I saw Armageddon.
Yeah, and the idea of sending a nuclear weapon up there to blow it up, if you just think about it a little bit, it doesn't work. If you blew up a big rock, you wouldn't really change its course. You would just have lots and lots of somewhat smaller rocks still heading for the Earth that could actually maybe cause even more damage if they were spread out. And then the other idea, to kick it rather than trying to blow it to bits, you aim some projectiles at it to try and knock it off its course. That's another idea. And then tug. This was actually an idea.
That's the one they like the best.
Yeah, and it's the one Rusty Schweikert, I think, a former NASA astronaut, one of the Apollo astronauts. He had the idea that if you put a spaceship near it, the gravitational pull of the spaceship, and maybe give that spaceship, especially if you had years to do this, give it a very, very slow push. You know, just you could gravitationally just nudge that asteroid far enough, and if you're millions of miles away, you wouldn't need to do it much to make it miss the Earth. That is the idea they like best, because then, you know, you have a long time, you can see, is it working? You don't risk, you know, you ram something into the rock and find out, oh, it's just a loosely packed pile of rubble, which some asteroids it's turning out are, and they break apart, and then what do you do? I've heard other ideas for those loose rubble ones where they've thought about making a big giant bag to put over it if it were of a size that would allow that. The problem is you would need years to do this, and we need to think ahead of time. We need to have this ready to go because, you know how things go when the governments get involved. It takes decades sometimes to get an idea past the thinking stage. And another concern is, this is if it's an asteroid that's orbiting the sun that we happen to find that may hit us at some point. The issue that is a little bit more scary, although it's not a high likelihood issue, is a comet coming in from far, far away, which they often do. We've never seen it before. It's never been here. It's coming from way out in the Oort cloud, they call it. And it's coming in, and, you know, we might find it and realize it's going to hit the Earth in 2 years. So we really need to – this is something we can solve. It would cost money, relatively little money compared to a lot of the other things we spend money on, and it could save the Earth.
Yeah. Well, that's probably worth the money.
Yeah, I think it would be.
I certainly do. Lewis in La Crosse, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, guys. While we're out there watching Venus in all its glory, the second brightest thing in this particular time, it's going to be on the 18th at 9:01 p.m. coming out of the west-northwest, is the good old reliable International Space Station. And on this particular night, its flight is going to take us right over the top. It won't be off on a horizon. It'll be right, you know, coming out of the west, probably right next to Venus, and then go straight over top, which makes it very, very, very bright. I kind of watch these almost continuously. You can find a schedule pretty easily online. And only a few of them go, you know, straight overhead, which makes them, you know, that much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, the International Space Station, you're right. When it does go overhead, it can be even brighter than Venus now.
Yeah.
It's the size of a football field. I haven't actually been able to do this, but I've heard that with some fairly powerful binoculars, you know, not anything out of reason, you can actually tell that it's got a shape, even though it's 240 miles up. And heavens-above.com has a very easy way. You can plug in your coordinates, your zip code or whatever, and it will tell you over the next, I believe, it's either a week or 10 days, whether the International Space Station is going to go over you, and it says the duration, the brightness, where it'll be in the sky. It takes 2 or 3 or even 5 minutes to cross the entire sky if it's visible for the whole path.
Now, another good website is spaceweather.com.
Right.
Up on top, there's a little link called Flybys. All you do is put in your zip code, and it gives you all that other good information, what time, how bright, things like that. And if you have a really powerful pair of binoculars, you can actually see who's driving the thing.
Oh, sure. that's a joke, folks. Although people have, from the ground, taken pictures of the International Space Station while one of the astronauts was outside, and they've gotten pictures where you can tell where the astronaut is. He might only be one pixel on the photo, but
you can tell.
There's the astronaut, which is just amazing to me. Yeah, and... You said that it'll be straight overhead, but it kind of depends on where you are. It's 240 miles up, but if you're in extreme northern Wisconsin compared to the very south, where it is in the sky might vary at least by a little bit.
Yeah, there we go. Lewis, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, with your questions. Give us a call or comments. Maybe you've got some good information to share as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, visiting with Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, active member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club, certainly willing to answer and talk with you about any stargazing-type questions you have. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Facebook comment from Treva: several times I've seen a star that looks to me like it's dying. It keeps flashing and climbing like it's, or dimming like it's exploding. I've seen it periodically since last fall. I'm in the Dousman area and I see it in the western sky toward the south. Is it a dying star?
No, it couldn't be a dying star. Typically, if a star dies, it doesn't do it over a period and fade. If a star dies, it blows up in a really big boom. And we wouldn't hear it, but it would suddenly, it would look normal, and then it would suddenly become very, very bright for a short while. There are no stars near enough to the Earth to see in the sky that are in any imminent danger of blowing up like that, at least in that part of the sky. There are a couple that are getting ready, and they could go, but they wouldn't be dimming and things like that. Usually if you see something near the horizon that seems to be getting brighter and dimmer and brighter and dimmer, it's because of the Earth's atmosphere. The lower an object is in the sky, the more it's likely to do that. Now, there are other, you know, in the western sky right now is the planet Venus, and it may be that you're seeing. I don't quite understand. Usually when you see something in the sky, you can't see it for more than a couple few months because as we go around the Earth, the sky changes. Just now I'm wondering if maybe earlier what you saw was the planet Jupiter and now you're seeing the planet Venus, but I'm not quite sure. Not sure if that's a satisfactory answer, but...
But it could be the two. You're thinking they're the same when they're actually
right.
Two different
ones. They could be two different things.
We had a Facebook question from Lynette. Do you have a Wisconsin schedule of your portable planetarium? And you sure do.
I sure do. I'm actually looking at it right now, but you can also go to my website, which is a little complicated. It's seeingstarswi, that's all one word, seeingstarswi.wordpress.com. And on the right side, you'll see a tab with some links, and one of them says calendar. And you can just click on that, and I just updated it last night to make sure it is up to date. And it's got the 13 different places that I'll be this summer.
And it's really cool. Explain what you've got there, because I think it's really neat. And you take it with you.
I do. I have a portable planetarium, so we can see the night sky during the day. It's a dome. Kids say it looks like it's made of duct tape, and it does, but it's not. And it when it gets blown up by basically a house fan, it's sort of like a bouncy house that you might see at a fair, but it doesn't have a bouncy floor. And it's 16 feet across, 10 and a half feet high. You crawl through a tunnel to get inside, and then I turn the lights off, and it's very, very dark. And I have a projector that projects stars onto the inside of the dome. And it's always fun when kids are in there. If I quickly move the sky, they go, oh, because you really do start to think I'm outside and it's night. And then when things move quickly, it sort of freaks them out. But, yeah, and then I show them constellations. It shows the sky as it will look above wherever we happen to be that night. And I'm able to control that and show them all the different things you might see in the sky.
It's really, really a cool thing. And you schedule these, and people can, if they wanted to schedule something, I know you're really busy this summer, but...
They can go to that
website.
That website, and there's contact information for me. Typically, I do it either with schools or in the summer. It's with public libraries. The public libraries here in Wisconsin are amazing, and there's each summer there's a theme for the summer library programs. And this year it's Heroes. So I created a new program called Heroes in the Sky. And we talk about the constellations that, you know, Hercules is up there, Perseus, a couple of heroes. And kids find this more cool. The monsters that they had to deal with, they're also up there. And then I also, in this program, I'll talk about heroes of science. I talk about Galileo and how he really risked a lot to take on the people that didn't want to... accept change in what we thought was going on up there. He aimed a telescope up and changed everything by you know, seeing moons of Jupiter and all that. But there were folks who were like, no, we don't want to accept this. Then I'll talk about the Apollo astronauts and pioneering women in space as well.
So lots of really great, fun and interesting things. And again, what's the website again?
It's seeingstarswi.wordpress.com.
Seeingstars.wi.
Seeingstarswi without a dot.
Yes.
But if you also just do my last name, a Google search for Kinzer Seeing Stars, K-I-N-Z-E-R, it'll take you there. You'll find it.
And I think we have it, Cheyenne, don't we have it up on our Facebook page? Yes, we do. I'm looking. Yeah, we've got it. So if you, if you didn't get all that, just go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll get it there.
And there, I've put some astro photos that I've taken all over on the different pages on the site, too. So it's just kind of fun to look around.
Yep, there we go. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Claire said in Baraboo, I saw something that looked like a comet or meteor flying over Devil's Lake. It looked like it was burning, and it was completely horizontal and very low in the sky. What could it have been?
Well, it wouldn't have been a comet if it was moving. Comets, you know, when you see photos of them, they look like something zipping through space, and they actually are, but they're millions of miles away, so they take weeks to zip by, sometimes months. It could easily have been a fireball, a meteor. A meteor is a rock that's out in space, and it happens that we are going around the sun very quickly. We go, you know, we're 93 million miles away. If you do the math, we're traveling 18 miles per second, I think, around the sun. That's very, very fast. And if a rock hits our atmosphere burns it up. When things rub together, there's friction, and when they rub that fast together, things get hot quickly. And if it looked like it was burning up, that is what it was doing. And if it was horizontal, zipping across the whole sky, it was probably hitting pretty low. And we haven't gotten to this yet, but there are things called meteor showers. There are times during the year when what we're doing is we're actually going through debris left by comets. Comets are balls of rock and ice that sometimes every once in a while they'll come in towards the sun and they'll whip around it and head back out into space. And as they're coming in, they start to melt. And think about it, it's a big ball of ice with a lot of dust and rocks in there. And if the ice melts, the dust and rocks are left behind. We pass through those trails and we see meteors. Not, you know, typically on any given night, if you get under dark skies and you look up, you're going to see three or four of these per hour. Maybe not bright ones, but little zing. They just zip across the sky really quickly. But on certain nights of the year, you might see 10 or more per hour, maybe even hundreds per hour if you're in a lucky, what they might call a meteor storm, where we're passing through a kind of thick bit of that tail.
And the Perseid meteor shower is kind of next, isn't it?
That's right. The Perseid meteor shower is a yearly shower on August 11th or 12th every year. On that night, if you can get out, especially if you can get away from town lights, you want the darkest skies you can to see the most meteors you can. Light pollution is an issue we could talk about for a long time, but you really want to get away from town and just lie down. Get a lounge chair, a sleeping bag, and you don't want binoculars or a telescope. There's no way of knowing where the meteor is going to appear, and they only last, at most a couple of seconds, so you wouldn't be able to get them in your sights anyway. You just want to use what I say to the kids, use your wide eyes. Don't look at one little bit of sky. Just keep your eyes open. Some of the brightest meteors that I've ever experienced were behind me. I was looking in one direction, and the ground lit up. And by the time I whipped around, the meteor was pretty much done. So, it's sort of hit and miss. But, that's a great night. And actually, somebody asked about my schedule on that night. I'll be in Albany, Wisconsin, doing a star party with telescopes, and hopefully we'll, along with the telescopes, we'll just look up and see meteors.
It's really cool. I can remember a night in November in northern Wisconsin, away from everything. I mean, it was pitch dark outside our cabin that we were at, and we had all the lights off, and what a difference it makes.
And it could well have been, if you're, in November, November 17th every year is the Leonid meteor shower. It is different. Perseids every year you see 50, 60 per hour if you're really lucky under really dark skies. But, you will see some if you're just patient. The Leonids, many years, you don't see many at all. But every once in a while, it is a really good one for meteor storms. And I believe the year 2001, I was in Nebraska, and my mouth was open most of the night because of all the amazingly, not just meteors, but amazingly bright meteors.
Yeah, it was, and I think it was that probably, we were probably looking at the same sky. Yeah, it was really something to see. I felt so blessed to have had that chance, and it was almost by accident.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's a neat thing that I don't have it here. It's on my website, but I got a, last summer, my son and I were in the Badlands, and I just had my telescope set up to take some pictures, frankly, for the cover of my book, the second edition of my book. And I was just setting up, and I had the camera, I'd opened the shutter, super bright meteor, and I caught it. And I was like, and there was no meteor shower. I've gone out trying to take photos during meteor showers, and I just happened to catch this one.
Oh, wonderful. Scott in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much. My question is from a book that I read a few years back called 9 Crazy Ideas in Science, Some of Which Might Be True. And one chapter of that book dealt with the idea of a nemesis star. And what this is based on is there is a certain pattern to mass extinction events in the history of life on Earth. And some people have speculated that these are maybe triggered by a planet that, since recorded history has not visited, obviously, but that periodically comes close enough to cause a gravitational pull that pulls bunches of comets that go smashing into the planets, and some of those have hit the Earth. And I was just wondering what your guess feeling about that theory is.
I've done some reading about that. There's a really great book called Death from the Skies by an astronomer named Phil Plate. And I believe he talks about that. The periodical mass extinction events, my reading is that they aren't cyclical enough for that to maybe hold water. But there are others who say, well, maybe. But even if it weren't a periodically repeating star, you know, over periods of tens of millions of years, it's possible that a star came through. That's a long, long time. There aren't any stars that close. But they did just find a red dwarf star, a very small star. They discovered it using some new telescopes and cameras that they have. And they found that it actually was fairly close to the solar system, 7 or 8 million years ago, and that it passed by. And, you know, if it were 7 or 8 million years ago, maybe we would have been able to see it in the sky, and maybe it would have caused something like you say. It is true there's a cloud of comets very, very far away from the sun, up, you know, half a light year away. And every once in a while, that cloud does seem to get disturbed and comets come toward us.
Yeah, very interesting. Scott, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Augusta, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon. To your guest, I picked up at a thrift sale last weekend a planetarium. It was in a box. The lid was missing. It's about 3 feet by maybe 15, 20 inches tall.
Uh-huh.
And it has the planet Earth, then it has the moon, then I believe it has Jupiter and Saturn. And this is, so swing arms that swing out. You can actually remove the whole thing.
Right.
I looked it up. It's pretty old. What do you think of that?
Well, if I'm understanding what you're saying, the proper name for that is and it's kind of funny when you say it out loud, orrery.
Orrery.
And I'm not quite sure how to spell it, but yes, it's basically a model of the solar system, and they've been making them for many hundreds of years, and you may, you know, if you can find out more about it, maybe companies make them. So it may only be 30 years old and not worth much, or who knows, you know, if you may have.
Yeah.
It's just like finding an old telescope. Sometimes people look and they do some research and they find out, oh my gosh, this is an Alvin Clark telescope, you know, or something. So I don't know what it is, but good for you.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah.
It's fun to have things like that.
Yeah.
I was thinking of when you were talking about finding things, I was thinking about the woman. Someone was telling me this story of a woman who threw out her apple. She had one of the originals.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That was like $100,000 or something.
Yeah.
Well,
and somebody found a very, very valuable, very old telescope. They bought a house and it was stored under their basement stairs, and it had been there, they think, for 50 years.
Oh.
Yeah, just these amazing stories.
Oh, my goodness me.
Yep.
Dave, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Jan in Trempealeau. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing very well, Jan. I know Jan, so here we go.
I was just wondering about the comet that's coming into the inner solar system this summer, and if you have any predictions on whether that'll be visible to the naked eye.
And,
you heard it closest pass to the sun was in August, but the Philae lander is sitting on it.
Right. Oh, okay. So that comet. Well, that comet has a very, very long name that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say, but people just call it Comet 67P because it was the 67th comet found to have a periodical visit to the sun. That's what the P stands for. Most comets zip in and zip out again. Actually, it's not a very bright comet at all. It comes every several years. Some comets only come every couple hundred or even thousands. Halley's Comet comes every 76 years. This one, it's I can't remember what it is, but it's not that many. The neat thing about it is, even if you can't see it naked eye, if you can find it with a telescope or binoculars, that's what most comets will do. And if you go online and just look up Comet 67P, they'll tell you that. I don't think it's supposed to get naked eye bright. But the interesting thing about that comet is it's got a man-made thing on it, or I should say people-made thing. And that thing just woke up again. I don't know. Did you read about that, Jan? This past weekend, the Philae lander that landed there last November, and people were very excited about it, first time we ever landed something on a comet. And land is interesting because the comet has so little gravity, they had to try and think of, how are we going to get this thing to stay on the comet? It had a spear that was supposed to, you know, harpoon it, and that didn't work. It had a couple of other things it was supposed to do. It ended up bouncing off, and it stayed. It bounced, and it slowly rose and then slowly fell again. An hour or more later, it landed, and it ended up landing in a little crevice or something. It wasn't aimed very well, and it did send back information for about 60 hours, and then its batteries died and couldn't recharge. But now that it's closer to the sun again, its batteries have charged up, and it woke up for a little while on Saturday, and they have hopes that they're going to be able to get information on it, because, as you say, this comet is getting closer and closer to the sun, and it'll get its closest in August, and then it'll whip around the sun, and they're hoping to get information not just from the lander, but from the orbiting spacecraft, Rosetta. They're hoping to get information from them well, you know, past the time it zips around the sun.
Very cool. Thanks very much for calling. You were talking to me, mentioning earlier before we were on the air, about photos that were coming from, I forget where, but it was going to take forever.
Oh, right. Oh, this is the other big thing. Even before August, when that comet whips around the sun, on July 14th, the New Horizons spacecraft, which has been heading towards Pluto for a decade, going over a million miles a day, it's going to finally reach Pluto on July 14th. And this is what they call a flyby mission, like the Voyager missions in the 70s, going past the bigger outer planets. It's going to whip past Pluto. And while it does, it's going to take lots and lots of photos. Those Voyagers, they had okay cameras, and they took some amazing pictures. But this will have a much higher resolution camera, and it'll have a bunch of other instruments on it. Interestingly, a couple of the instruments, one of them is named Ralph, and the other one is named Alice, from the Honeymooners. I haven't found where they got those nicknames, but those are the nicknames for an ultraviolet instrument and an infrared instrument. It's going to whip by. It's going to take a lot of pictures. And it is so far away, and its signal strength is so weak, it's going to take a year and a half to relay all the pictures it takes over those few days. It's going to take a year and a half to get them all back to the Earth.
That's amazing.
Now, they are saying it's right away they're going to get back a dozen or so really high-resolution photos so that people can see that Pluto is a planet.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. They're hoping to prove that.
Yeah, and the lead scientist on the mission, Dr. Stern, I don't have his first name here. Here's a quote from him. He said that astronomers who are non-experts in planetary science basically passed off a bunch of BS on the public back in 2006. A week later, hundreds of planetary scientists, more people than at that meeting in Prague that demoted Pluto, signed a petition that rejects the new definition. If you go to planetary science meetings and hear technical talks on Pluto, you will hear experts calling it a planet every day. So the controversy comes back.
Paul Kinzer, our guest today, talking with him about what's going on in the heavens, in the stars, summer stargazing. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at what's going on in our heavens, the stargazing with Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. He's an active member as well of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. He has a a wonderful, wonderful, I don't know if you, I guess you could call it business in a way. And he's got his own, he's got his own, what would you call it? His own constant, I'm suddenly blanking on
planetarium.
Planetarium, yeah. Mm-hmm. Portable planetarium that he takes, can take around, maybe to your neck of the woods. Probably is, mm-hmm. because he's going to several places around Wisconsin this summer, and you can find out where he's going to be if you go to his website. And again, your website is
seeingstarswi.wordpress.com.
Seeingstars.wi.wordpress.com. Also available on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. So we're certainly glad to have him along. Again, you can join us. I have an open line at 800-642-1234. Chris and Madison up next. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I'm a member of the Madison Astronomical Society, and it's good to hear someone talking about astronomy on the radio. But I wanted to mention a chance in the Madison area to observe the Perseid meteor shower.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We're having an observing event at Donald Park, west of Madison, August 14th. And the rain date is August 15th, and we'll be there with our telescopes and our chairs, and we'd love to have people come and join us and watch the meteors and look at the stars.
So that's at Donald Park?
Donald Park, yeah, that's south of 1218, about a half hour out of Madison, west of Madison.
Mm-hmm.
They have a map on their website.
And do you have their website by chance?
I don't, but if you Google Donald, Friends of Donald Park.
Okay. It'll be there.
It will come up. Yeah.
All right, great.
Also, it will be, once we get closer, it will be on the Madison Astronomical Society's website with a map.
Great.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And that's August 14th, and with a rain date of the 15th. So you're kind of hoping for, a day like we have out there today. It's a pretty, pretty nice day across all of Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. Chris, thanks again for calling. Jim and Custer, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Just a comment about if you have an Apple device, there is something called Pocket Universe. It's an app. And it's fascinating for eyeball astronomy. And there's one part of it, you can see the virtual sky. You can take it out at night and you know, compare your screen with what you're looking at in the sky.
Right.
Orrery that you can see your. I mean, you can see where you are in the solar system. You can turn it in a way you can see that it's flat,
uh-huh.
and you can position. You can see your position on the Earth to be able to visualize how you're looking across on the other side of the sun to see Jupiter,
sure,
and Venus, and
very cool, isn't it?
Yeah, and every time I'm on the show, apps come up.
Yeah,
and I am not an owner of smart technology, but yet I do. I know there are thousands, literally thousands, of different apps for astronomy that you can get for whatever smart technology you have. I'm going to talk a bit about a planetarium program called Stellarium, Stellarium. You can get it for your laptop, and it is it can show you what the night sky looks like above your home. You know, you put in your location at any given moment from many thousands of years ago till many thousands of years from now, and it'll show you where the moon is and the planets and all that. And it gives realistic sky things, and then you can zoom way, way, way in on things. And you can also do that. You can put yourself on the surface of Mars and see what the sky would look like from there or other places. And that's just one. And Stellarium does have, what is it called here? There's another version of Stellarium that also you can put on your smartphone, and it will allow you to simply aim your phone at a part of the sky or even the ground, and it'll tell you what's in that direction. Very cool stuff. And I know you, Larry, you have an astronomy program.
I have Star Tracker.
Uh-huh.
It's called Star Tracker, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking up, people are saying, what's that? And I'm like, well, if I don't know myself right away, or even sometimes I'll say, and they'll say, oh, that's not, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's get this out.
So we pull it out. Up there. Yep.
You aim it up there, and it tells you.
Yeah, and just five or six years ago, two different telescope companies came out with these little handheld devices that they charged $300 or $400 for that would do that. And like 2 years later, somebody came up with a $2 app that would do the same thing. And some of the apps are even free. And they, you know, they range in price from free to just a few dollars. It's just, it's amazing what you can do now.
I can't even remember. I think Star Tracker might be free. If it wasn't free, I didn't pay more than a dollar or two
for it. And another very famous one is called Sky Safari, I think, for Apple. But I think they have versions for other phones, too. And again, most of them, or many of them, they will have several different levels. You know, a basic one is free. And then one that, there are some that literally have tens of millions of stars they can show you. Those might cost a few dollars.
Thanks again, Jim. Mark in Mellon, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing today?
Great.
Perfect. Appreciate your call. You're calling from northern Wisconsin.
Well, right now I'm traveling through the cities, but and I think you may have just answered my questions. I'm a novice sky watcher. I caddy on the professional golf tours and the camping tour, and I do a lot of camping. So I spend a lot of evenings gazing at the stars, and I was just wondering good places to go to find out, you know, where I'm at certain times. And I think you guys just answered my question.
Yeah, these apps work very, very well. Stellarium, again, is another great program. And there are so many websites. Somebody mentioned one earlier that can have things that maybe these apps don't have because it's stuff that just comes up. Northern lights, sunspots, things that aren't really predictable. And, and one thing I'll mention now is some of these programs, too, if, say, a comet is in the sky and they know its orbit, you can go online with these programs. And I've only done this once, so I can't really explain it, but you can punch in the coordinates and then you can then see where is that comet going to be in a few weeks, a few months, or whatever. But as far as more peripheral things like Northern Lights, there's a website called spaceweather.com. Just one word, spaceweather.com. It's run by a NASA scientist. And it every day it shows you what's on the sun, and every day the sun looks different. There are sunspots. It will let you know if there's been a solar storm that spit something towards the Earth, which might mean in a couple of days there'll be Northern Lights. But it's really hard to predict Northern Lights. They, you know, that storm might cause them, and then sometimes, it didn't this time, and then other times there are Northern Lights and there was no storm. So not entirely predictable, but that's one more idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my cabin is in the Pinoki Mountain Range just north of Mellon, and we get the Northern Lights quite often, but, you know, we never know when they're going to appear.
Yeah, that website will at least be able to tell you there could be. My brother-in-law is a professional landscape and nature photographer, and he has sometimes gotten these reports and just, just drives north. He lives in Minnesota, and he'll head way up to the North Shore and stuff, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes it doesn't. Thanks, Mark.
Well, thanks, and if you need a caddy sometime, Larry, give me a call.
I was going to say, you've got a job that I'd love to take part in someday.
Yeah, right now I'm heading for Sacramento, California, in the Senior U.S. Open next week.
Oh, wow. Do you have somebody that you're going to work for yet, or are you just going to wait?
I work for Gary Hallberg, and I also work for Hale Irwin once in a while.
Oh, wonderful! Well, good luck next week.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. That's a cool job to have. Ray and Rhinelander, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. Once again, Larry, you always have fantastic guests on here, and your guest is fascinating with his knowledge, too. Three things. The Orion system. In the wintertime, it's so clear to see it, and it's pretty much stationary, moves to the left, to the right a little bit. This time of the year, it seems to bounce around, and I'm curious about everything shifts, of course, because of rotations and that, but Orion seems to be playing like a baseball game up there sometimes. And how far south do you have to be, or what's the furthest northern part that you have to be able to see the Southern Cross? And also, have you heard of the man who painted the universe, the Kovac Planetarium in Monaco, Wisconsin? And I will take your comment off there. And thanks for being on the air. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling.
First of all, Orion, the Orion system, if you're talking about the constellation, it's actually only visible in the winter. We see it in the winter, and of course, right now nights, it's only dark for a few hours every night. In the winter, it's dark for 14 or 15, mm-hmm. so we get a brighter look at the sky and earlier in the evening. And I'm not quite sure how far south you have to be before you can see the Southern Cross. I lived in New Mexico, and you couldn't see it there. You'd have to have to be further south in the United States. And yes, I have heard of that planetarium. There's a great write-up in Sky and Telescope magazine about it.
And there's a new book out on it.
Oh,
as well.
Oh, okay.
So, which we may talk about on the show someday. We're talking today, though. With our guest, Paul Kinzer. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30. Look at the news, then we'll be back. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, having a lot of fun today talking about our skies, our night skies. And if you love astronomy, boy, even if you don't, even if you're just mildly interested, you're going to enjoy listening to what Paul Kinzer has to say. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, an active member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. And, Paul, thanks again for visiting with us today.
Well, again, I love to come.
It's a lot of fun to have you with us. And, by the way, your book is coming out on a second edition?
That's right. The original came out in 2008, and I've completely updated it. Not completely. Some of the information is as old as telescopes, but it's updated with more modern equipment, and it's for folks who maybe looked through a telescope and said, boy, I want to get one of these. Well, there's a lot of really great stuff out there and a lot of junk, and I kind of help folks know the difference. And then I also talk in there about what basically is up there in the night sky.
This really sounds cool. And when is it going to be out?
The date is August, but from what I know about publishing, sometimes things happen. And that's so far anyway, the date, August of this year.
Well, when it comes out, you'll have to let us know, and we'll
sure will.
And we'll have you back and talk some more about the book and certainly about the night sky as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have, boy, there's been lots of callers, lots of questions. Dave in Madison's been waiting a while. Dave, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Well, thanks, Larry. And, Paul, this is a great show. I love this. I saw something about 3 weeks ago that kind of got me scratching my head. It looked to me like sort of like a fireball in the sky. It was very high up in the sky, but it was quite straight and not particularly fast moving and relatively short. Maybe I would say it tracked about 3 or 4 widths of the moon.
Uh-huh.
And it looked almost like if you know, Star Wars fan, when they turn on the lightsaber and it kind of just slowly rises up. It looked like that, very bright. And I thought it must be some sort of fireball. But then the next day, I heard that there had been quite a display of aurora visible in the Madison area from a Class X flare that had happened. And I wonder, is there any phenomena like that associated with solar flares?
Well, aurora can do really weird things, so you know that's possible. I just want to—you say it was a straight. Did it sort of increase in brightness and then decrease in brightness?
That was another thing that was strange about it. It just seemed very constant.
Huh? You have me stumped. I have no idea. I have no idea what that was. No idea.
That is...
I mean, if it had faded in and faded out, I might have had a couple. But if it just... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it was. So what does that mean? It means it was a UFO. Because we don't know what it was.
That's right.
I would say it probably wasn't aliens, though. Almost certainly.
But it's a UFO anyway.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know what it was.
Unidentified flying object. There we go. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Appreciate it. Pete in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Larry and Paul. I'm looking at the eclipse map for 2017, which I hope Paul will talk about and make sure the rest of the listeners know this is a big deal to go to it.
Yes.
But I'm wondering where to go. I'm wondering what Paul's strategy is as far as picking a location, for me at least, preferably between about 500 and 1,000 miles maximum by car, where I can best have the best chances of not dealing with weather and clouds and things like that, for because I want to see this eclipse. I really do.
Yeah, okay, I do. And thanks for calling, Pete. First of all, this will be the first solar eclipse, total solar eclipse, to really be across a large swath of the United States in my lifetime, and I'm in my 50s. There have been some in Canada. There have been some that have touched different parts. That song by Carly Simon, You're So Vain, she has a line in there about you went to Nova Scotia to see the total eclipse of the sun. I have a photograph of my brother holding a telescope up, and you can see an image on a piece of paper of a partial eclipse from where we were in St. Paul at the time. This one is going to start on the West Coast, and it's going to go through Oregon, Idaho, Wyoming, Nebraska, Missouri, Southern Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, a bit of Northern Georgia, and then it's going to leave the U.S. through South Carolina. So a huge swath of the country is going to be able to see it. My understanding, my knowledge about this is, if you want the best chance of no clouds, you want to go west. And there was recently an article a few months ago in Sky and Telescope with lots of information, including, I believe, a chart showing where where at least climatically and historically where the least clouds would be. And there are also places online that have similar things. NASA has a very – I sent a link to the show about NASA has a very good website with lots of information. And I have something saved somewhere on my computer, somewhere in eastern Oregon. Now, that's further than you want to go, Pete. But, again, I would think if you went west, Nebraska often has very, very clear skies. And that might be a good bet.
Or Wyoming, east of the Rocky Mountains?
Yeah, yep. And it's going to cross both of those states, so, yep.
There you go. Thanks, Pete. Thanks a lot for calling. I was trying to remember when the last, I mean, it's been more than 50 years.
Right, and I don't know. I don't frankly care what happened before I was born to about eclipses. And there are people, they call them eclipse chasers. There are people with way more money than me who travel around the world because most years there's a solar eclipse somewhere. But you may have to go to Antarctica or the Sahara or the center of Asia or something to see it, or even in the ocean. So this is the one I've been waiting. Since that picture was taken in 1970, they had maps then. They knew this one was going to happen, and I looked at that map when I was 9 and said, that's the one for me. Yes, I'll be in my 50s, but that's the one for me.
Ralph in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling.
My question was, you get these things you can name a star after someone and they register in some vault somewhere. Can you actually see those if you had a powerful enough telescope, or are they just so obscure that you'd never, ever find them?
Well, I have a suggestion that I give when I get asked this question. First of all, you can do that, and this is just a company, and they're just making money off of you. The star is not officially in any way named for the person you want it to be. And there are similar companies. You can name a crater on the moon or whatever. But there are billions and billions of stars out there, and most of them are not visible to the naked eye. And the ones that are visible, they already have names. So I suggest that you find a star in a chart or something and just name it yourself. And do it yourself, and you can – that you know, to me, that shows I took the time to find this star, and – there it is right there. and that's the one I'm giving to whoever I'm giving a star to. You know, if you want to do that, it is, it's a fun thing. It's just not an official thing. And I don't know a lot about them. You know, some of them are not honest, though, and they say the star really will be named. Well, if they're not honest about that, are they even really naming a real star?
Yeah.
I don't know enough to tell you.
Yeah. So something to think about, Ralph. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dan and Madison, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about cleaning a telescope. I have a, I don't remember what kind. It's just like a 6-inch thing. It's pretty dusty. And online, I found this stuff called First Contact Polymer. Mm. I was wondering if you've ever heard of it or tried it before.
No, I never have. And is it a reflecting telescope with a mirror, or is it a telescope with a lens?
It's a telescope with a mirror.
To me, the easiest way to clean them is with distilled water. We'll usually get the dust off. If it doesn't, like a small amount of water with like a drop of Dawn dishwashing liquid, and then you put that on there, and then without putting any pressure at all, just kind of drag a very lint-free cotton cloth across it, and then you rinse it, you know, for a while. You just have it in running water, sitting on a towel or something, and then final rinse with 91% isopropyl alcohol, which will evaporate. That is what most people would say to do with the mirror. And unless it's really, really dusty, many people would say don't do anything, because the coating on the mirror is very delicate, easily scratched. And as far as that product goes, for all I know, it's great, but I've never heard of it.
Okay. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Dan. And finally, after a long time, we have some open lines. So yeah, there's open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. John in Montana wonders if you have suggestions for telescopes for people just starting to get into this hobby. Where can I look? What's a good, you know, what's a price range that's reasonable? You're going to get something for your money.
Yeah, and these are exactly the questions I answer in my book. So yeah, I will suggest my book. It will really help you to learn. You know, so much of it depends on, well, if you're actually in Montana, you know, you probably want the largest mirror or lens you can get. The bigger the mirror or lens, the more you'll be able to see and the sharper the viewing will be. That's just optics and the laws of physics. Now, a person who's in a city or a person who needs something very portable might have make a different choice. As far as a price range goes, I would say you're not going to get a really decent telescope unless you really know what you're doing for under $200. And if you're willing or able to spend, say, $500, then you can get something very, very nice, something that probably would be all you would ever need. But there's so many factors, and it's kind of positive and negative. There are so many choices nowadays. And a lot of them, frankly, are garbage. They're junk. And they might cost $500, and they still might not be that great. So
You really have to be careful.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it pay to go to an optics store? I mean, there are
stores that sell telescopes, but I'll tell you, usually it's a camera store, a sporting goods store, and there are some that have very knowledgeable folks, but many that I've been to, when I've asked questions about telescopes, it's clear to me they don't really know what they're talking about. And they might not tell you they don't know what they're talking about, mm-hmm, but you can't really know. I think my book, I'm not, you know, trying to get you to buy my book, libraries have it, but I do think it's a good resource to answer a lot of the basic questions to get you started. Now, in the book, I recommend a refractor on a type of mount called an equatorial mount. That allows you to follow the stars more simply. And you could just, you know, Google those terms. A refractor, you won't be able to get as big a lens as you would if you bought a reflector with a mirror for the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. But a refractor needs no maintenance. You just basically take it out and look through it.
Yeah. And there's virtue to that for sure.
Yeah.
Jeanette in La Crosse, again, wondering about the next meteor storm. There was one in 2001. This was earlier.
Right. And that's during Leonids. And the Leonids, I can't remember which comet it is that we travel through the tail of, but that comet comes towards the Earth every so many years. If you did a Google search for Leonid, that's L-E-O-N-I-D, storm, and maybe just the word next, you know, I bet you'd get results telling you when the next one would be. It's decades between them, though. I don't think the next one is for decades.
And then the Perseid meteor shower, if you wanted a shower, is coming up.
That's right. The night of August 12th. It won't be a storm. That storm I was talking about, you know, I was seeing every minute I was seeing more than a dozen of them.
Yeah.
And you won't, that probably won't happen. But you could see, you know, 20, 30, 40 in an hour. Yep. And that's pretty neat.
We have an email from Amanda. My four-year-old son is obsessed with space. He has all the planets memorized, wants to be a space scientist when he grows up. Anywhere I can take him this summer? And I wish I knew where you were from, Amanda.
Well, one place you can take him is anywhere away from lights. Light pollution is a big deal. We do have some fairly dark skies here in Wisconsin, but the farther away you can get from lights, the better, and then just lie down. My son and I, this summer, we're going to go back to the Badlands, and that's a beautiful place out in South Dakota. There's a place in northern Nebraska, the Sand Hills. The nearest town's 40 miles away, and it only has 3,000 people. You know, if you can get to a really dark sky, and if you can borrow a small telescope, even a small telescope, this summer, Saturn will be in the sky every night. Every night, mm-hmm. Saturn will be up. And if you can look at Saturn through a telescope, even if your son wasn't already obsessed, I think he'd become obsessed because seeing Saturn through a telescope is amazing.
Is amazing.
Even a small one. When you see that ball with the rings around it floating in space, it is amazing.
I was thinking immediately to the Shawamigan National Forest, where I've spent a number. There's nothing. I mean, there's nothing for miles in any direction. And it's pitch black.
Yes, yes. It is very, very dark there. I'll tell you, though, Larry, it's not as dark as Nebraska anymore. Partially because just the atmosphere. You're at a higher elevation when you're out there. And yet, yes, if you can get out to the National Forest, especially where there's some open air, and you have plenty of bug repellent.
Yes. Dan in Waupaca, the moon is covered with craters, but I've never heard anything about the moon getting hit.
For a crater to be big enough to see from the Earth, it would need to be a pretty big rock hitting the moon. Most of those craters are billions of years old. Some of the brighter, fresher ones, they're millions of years old. It would take quite a big rock to see that. There is some evidence that some people have, a monk a few hundred years ago claimed to have seen something on the moon. And yet people have looked at the moon where he thought he saw it, and they haven't found any fresh craters. So, it takes a pretty big rock.
And the moon itself,
the theory on that is billions of years ago when the solar system was forming, here was Earth. It wasn't as big as it is now, and something about the size of Mars slammed into it. And when it did, a lot of things flew off, and those things over a period of years fell back together and became the moon.
Mm-hmm. That's I was just reading about that the other day, came up.
Yeah. You've heard of the Big Bang. Some people call that the Big Splash or the Big something or other, some not very pleasant word, but yeah.
And Jeff was reminding there's a decent viewing on the International Space Station tonight, at least from Appleton, at about 9:15. 68 degrees maximum height appears 44 degrees above the northwest.
Yeah, and again, if you go to that website, heavens-above.com or spaceweather.com, they can tell you to the second when you'll be able to see it. And once if you're looking in the right part of the sky, you're like, well, I wonder if it's... Oh. There it is. You can't miss it. You can't.
Question from Matt in Sparta. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My question to the guest is I'd like to be able to see the Messier objects. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. Yep. Messier catalog.
Mm-hmm.
As well as get a really good look at the rings of Saturn and whatnot. What would be, and be able to take pictures. You know, what would your guest suggest to be a good setup for that?
The Messier objects, first to say what they are, Charles Messier was an astronomer hundreds of years ago in France. He had a small telescope. He wanted to find comets, and he'd look at the sky, and he'd find these things and go, is that a comet? Oh, that's not a comet. And he'd mark them in his charts. There's 109 of them, and they're called the Messier objects, and people go and try and find them. And now we know that they're galaxies and star clusters and things like that. How to take a picture of them? You want the darkest skies you can get, and I really don't have time to go into a lot of detail here, but it really varies depending on the object. Some of them are very tiny and dim. Some are very fairly large in the sky and bright. A digital SLR camera attached to a telescope on an equatorial mount that can track the sky, because you'll need to leave your camera open for minutes and the Earth spins. And it is not easy. Believe me, it's not easy to get really sharp ones. Planets are a bit easier, Saturn. But then you're going to need a pretty powerful telescope because it's far away and not very big. You know, you can see the rings even if you magnify things only about 50 times. But through your telescope, that 50 thing magnified 50 times is going to be very, very tiny. And it will make a very small image on your camera. Typically what people do is they use special astro cameras that take video of Saturn and then use free software to process it. CloudyNights.com has several forums on planetary photography and deep space photography. I suggest you go to there because it's actually very complicated.
Thank you so much for calling. And again, Paul, I want to get back to your work and where you're going to be this summer. You have lots of events coming up this summer. It's going to be a lot of fun with your portable unit. And starting coming up here.
Yeah, I can quickly. I mean,
you'll be in Kiel on June 24th.
Yep, and then I'll be in Keewaskum and Lemaira on the 29th, and on the 30th I'll be out there with my scopes in Ripon. On the 2nd of July, I'll be in Ettrick. The 9th, I'll be in Westfield. The 10th, I'll be in West Bend. The 14th, in Tomahawk. 15th, in Waterloo. The 21st, I'll be in Pittsville and Nakusa.
Mm-hmm.
And
Minocqua. Trempealeau County Fair?
Yep. So the Trempealeau County Fair, that's when I'm unavailable because I'm actually working at the fair. I'll be in Minocqua on July 30th. I'll be again with my telescopes on August 12th in Albany, and the next day in Albany with the planetarium. So many, many different things that I'll be doing.
And it's seeingstars...
wi.wordpress.com.
Boy, has this been a lot of fun. We didn't get to everything either, did we?
Nope, we didn't.
We tried, but we'll have you back, and certainly we're going to do this again. It was so much fun, and I'll look forward to your next visit, Paul. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Take a look at Paul's site, and you're going to find out where he is and the times, and also it's a way to contact him. You may be interested in getting something going for your neighborhood or for your community. And
I love questions, too. If folks have questions, they can sure email me through the website.
Through the website. All right. Paul Kinzer, our guest, and he will be back. Tomorrow we'll talk, we'll learn what factors are preventing clean lakes here in Wisconsin. Then 11:45, we'll talk about summer biking safety. So lots to talk about. And you know what? There's lots to talk about all afternoon here on the Ideas Network. I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.